Welcome to the Land Investing Business Secret Podcast, where each short episode, we talk about the strategies, experiences, and the tools to help you launch, grow, and scale your land business. Learn how to find freedom within your own business, find out ways to build consistency in your processes, and hear how other everyday land investors are winning so you can get to the next step closer to building your dream life through your land business. And I'm your host of the Land Investing Business Secrets Podcast by Pebble, Jesse Kwong. Hey, how's it going? This is Jesse here from the Land Investing Business Secrets Podcast. I've got a special guest, Dan. Dan Haberkost is on the show here with us. And man, this is an episode where he drops a lot of insight. And honestly, some things I've never thought about when it comes to marketing to sellers. So you definitely want to pay attention to this episode. You're probably going to want to listen to this twice because you can tell Dan has a lot of experience when it comes to land, specifically when it comes to marketing. So I hope you guys are ready for this episode with your pen and paper. Enjoy this episode here with Dan Haberkost. Today, Dan, I'm going to butcher your last name. I feel is it Haberkost or Haberkost?
Haberkost.
Haberkost. Okay. Yes. And I'm doing this on air. Can you believe that? Like I'm asking you on air in front of everybody. I apologize.
It's okay. No worries.
Dan, can you share with us a little bit about, you know, how you got started in the land investing space?
Yeah. So I started buying real estate, rental properties, my last year of college when I was 21 and, bought a house hack, moved to Colorado, bought another house hack and quickly realized that the low and no money down stuff, as far as actual investing, buy and hold investing, it's great for a couple properties, maybe a couple house hacks, but in the long run, if you want to accrue a significant portfolio of real estate, you got to make money. And so I had a normal job, you know, making 60, 70 grand, whatever. And I thought, all right, well, where or how can I start some sort of active business within the realm of real estate, which I was already getting to know, to scale my income. And so I met a investor at the local real estate group here in Colorado Springs who'd been doing land and development for the past 45 years, you know, longer than I'd been alive. And so I went and I'd help him in his business, learned from him, worked for him, and he was doing a bunch of infill new construction. And so that's where I first got introduced to land is actually building homes.
Wow.
And we were doing this on finished infill parcels. And so I started to source additional parcels for building by going direct to seller. And so that was my first experience. I think the first ever land deal I did, I made $1,000 assignment fee. And so ultimately that's where my business Front Range Land came from. So fast forward to today, and it's just a giant marketing funnel going direct to seller for land. We buy it at 30 to 70 cents on the dollar. A lot of it we just buy and sell. Occasionally I'll do assignments, and I'm still doing some new construction and working on some larger, going after some larger subdivides as well.
So interesting. So you started outside of land that, you know, in really the, outside of land, and then that brought you into land. And then you mentioned you worked for others, to get an understanding of land. Were you planning to stick around with that other company and help them out? Was it always a plan to kind of, you know, have that as a stepping stone to run your own land business?
It wasn't official. He was just a mentor, a friend. And so I would just go drive an hour south to Pueblo, Colorado, for anyone who knows where that is, an hour south of Colorado Springs, and help him and learn from him. And so I never officially worked for him as an employee, but I was always just kind of, you know, following around, helping him. So yeah, that was clearly the whole intent. And he, you know, didn't have kids and I think wanted to pass on what he knew, having done it for years and years. And so it's just a friend today.
Oh man, that's awesome. And then, so you did that around 21, fast forward to today now, you know, how many years later is this now? And how has your business grown since then?
Sure. So 6 years ago, I'm about to turn 28, so I'm 27. And so I've continually bought rental properties along the way, right? So land has served its purpose for me, for what I wanted to do, which was scale my income and then allow me to take that cash and buy nice buy and hold rentals. So continually buying rental properties. And on the land side, I have two acquisition people, done several hundred deals, doing a ton of business in the Southeast, here in Colorado still, some miscellaneous deals. And then along with that, Mason and I don't know if you know him, but many of your listeners will, actually started Ground Up Partners, where we're capital providers for land deals as well. And that was just to solve our own problem where, funding for land is hard to come by relative to other real estate assets. And so Continually growing Front Range Land, my active day-to-day business, and then also working on growing the capital business as well.
Now, a couple things here. You mentioned you're working in Colorado. So you staying in your own state, is that correct?
Some, but then also quite a bit in the Southeast.
Oh, okay, got you. Yeah,
Florida and the Carolinas as well.
Got you. Mm-hmm. Now, all this is funneling towards your buy and holds, is that correct?
That's the goal, yeah.
Can you explain to me that whole thought process? You know, the whole goal you're telling me. I mean, that is your big picture here. You want to funnel things into a buy and hold. Why do that? And, you know, why not just flip for cash and continue to just grow the business itself? It sounds like you're very clear on your end goal here.
Well, there's several reasons. And taxes have become a problem, right? So I did a cost segregation studies on a few of the buildings I own. And that's saving me a lot of money in taxes. So that's a huge advantage. But also just planting seeds for the future where, sure, they make a bit of money now. But, you know, if I look at a financial statement for myself, a lot of the net worth comes from just appreciation, mortgage pay down, and buying these buildings at a discount. And so, you know, I've got a couple duplexes I'm having built right now. Wow. Cost everything, it will be about 430-ish, and then the contractor building them, she just did a couple and they appraised at 580. So I'll have over 100, let's say that comes down, I'll have comfortably 100 grand in equity in both of those. They'll make me $1,000 or $1,200 a month, and it's brand new construction in a decent area where we can put tenants that we'll never hear from, and assuming that we don't again mess up on the screen, there's no repairs for years to come. So that's why the income, but then also the tax shelter, not sheltering, wrong word, tax mitigation, and then just the equity that's built over time, which can then be leveraged again, right? So I use lines of credit for my rental properties all day in my land business, right? And so there's a lot of value to having nice buy and hold assets with a solid chunk of equity that make you money every month.
Got you. Now, have you always thought as buy and hold was the end game from the very start?
That's what I learned about. So backing up, I didn't tell part of the story. So what got me to the point of buying that first duplex was I read Rich Dad Poor Dad. And so the whole concept of, you know, the four different classes and having your assets make you money is what got me interested in real estate in the first place. That really is, how do I say, and I'm rambling a little bit here, but I'm trying to make several points. For me, I want to, along with the active land business, be doing something that will ensure that, you know, 40-year-old me will be very comfortable. And so I am working to scale the land business and make more and more money there. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what can I do? You know, if everything goes to hell and something goes wrong with land, or the market becomes really efficient and getting deals doesn't really work. Well, if I've accrued a solid portfolio of nice rental properties, that's a good kind of fallback, you know, and it gives you that base of income to then assess and readjust if I ever need to.
I love that. And so on average, how many, this is probably hard for you to answer here, but how many land deals do you need to do in order to be able to acquire, you know, a piece, you know, a home for your buy and hold?
Well, let me just use the duplex as an example. Sure. I paid for one of them, $20,000 for the land, $5,000 in permitting and engineering, so $25,000. I'll put like another $20,000 into it. The rest will be under a loan. So I'll put about $50,000 into it. And I mean, the land deals, the size varies so much. It's kind of a scenario where the average isn't always represented. So some of them will make 40 and then some of them will make 7. So let's just average it at 4 land deals need to be done to get that down payment for another one of those. We'll call it.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. And so how are you splitting your time between the land business and buy and hold? I'm assuming with the buy and hold, you're not actively involved. At the same time, it sounds like with your land business, you've got a couple of key players in there that sort of keep the business moving forward. What is your, you know, what does that split look like for you? And what does a day-to-day look like for you?
Almost entirely land. The rentals don't really take any time.
Yeah.
And that's partially just, I've been intentional where I only want to buy and hold real estate that's younger than me and in areas where I can get tenants with 700 plus credit scores. So if you do that, you have nice buildings and nice areas with nice tenants, it really can be pretty close to passive. So my time is spent working on a lot of content related work like this and my podcast that I do with Mason, and then raising money, managing people. I've got to get better there at working on hiring another employee right now because one just left. And that's where I've struggled. That's been my biggest bottleneck, is hiring good people. So spending a lot of time there. And then I still do, you know, data pull and control of where the marketing's going. That's still me. I don't talk to sellers anymore, barring, you know, big fires or anything. Yeah. But yeah, it's more, I definitely spend a lot of time planning and directing the marketing and just creative marketing ideas, too. I spend time there as well.
Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, you spend a lot of time with the marketing side. I'm assuming on the acquisition side of things. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the planning. So pulling, deciding on where we're going to continue marketing, what new areas we're going to try, what new marketing methods we're going to try, because there's a lot of groupthink. It's easy to just do what everyone else is doing. And so we spend a lot of time building out that seller avatar that sells land at a discount and aligning all of our marketing accordingly. Our postcards, our cold calling script, website, you know, or on Better Business Bureau, Trustpilot, Facebook, all that. And being really intentional about looking at the pain points of that seller and then aligning all of our marketing while trying to be different and unique from everyone else's.
What would you say, you know, you don't have to go too in depth on this and it's up to you. Like, what are some of the things that you feel that you are sort of breaking the mold that a lot of people sort of follow when it comes to your marketing? Maybe it's within your branding or your messaging. What do you feel like, you know, maybe top three things that you are doing differently that you think are moving the needle for you?
So done over 200 land deals and distress, maybe 5% of the time, it tends to more be they want certainty, closure, and legitimacy. They're afraid of scams. They don't want to deal with realtors. They're more apathetic and it's a sunk cost in their mind and they don't want to deal with it. And so when I see quick cash close, I got a land offer letter yesterday and it was bad. It was so bad. It just, I don't know who would respond to it, man. It looks scammy. It says, I sold this lot for 110. We bought it for 60 and it was owned by Front Range Land because we found the company or the end buyer ahead of time. I owned it for 11 days and somehow I got a land offer letter at 20,000. So these people are just wasting their money that are sending stuff like that. Wow. And it emphasizes quick cash close. Well, first of all, it's land. So what else are you going to buy it with? It's land. Of course you got to pay cash. I mean, yes, seller financing applies, but you know what I'm saying. And especially considering the avatar we've dealt with. And then number two, the quick thing is rarely important. Like, we have one deal under contract that I think illustrates the overarching concern of these sellers, where this is an extreme example, but he and his wife were incredibly concerned about scams. We had to get him on the phone with our attorney and title agent repeatedly, who of course vouched for us because we closed a million deals through them. Proof of funds, non-refundable earnest money, had to mail the contract with our frequently asked question sheet. Again, with the attorney's phone number, call them with any questions, and just doing everything we can to solidify, hey, we're going to send the money. We can't, you know, just like if you don't sign, they send the money back. If we don't send the money, they rip up your paperwork, right? And so focusing all our marketing around that has really served well. And honestly, one other tagline that has worked is, I'll put tired of fake offers on the postcard. That has worked really well because we get deals all the time where they fall out of contract with a higher offer because that person didn't have the ability to close.
Right.
And then they come back to us and we get the deal. And there's nothing wrong with assignments. We do it, but you need to know what you're doing and not just be wasting people's time and putting dozens of lots under a contract with no ability to close. Because a lot of these examples are the offers they're getting are full market price. Like, these people, unless it's actually the end builder, that they're certainly just wasting their time, you know? So legitimacy and certainty of closure are the biggest pain points we found.
Wow, that's so interesting. And so these are pain points that you found with your sellers. Mm-hmm. How did you find that out? What did you do to figure it out? And what are you continuing to do to sort of figure the messaging out?
Yeah. So Really, it was just iteration over time, learning that, because my first mailers all said quick cash close. So I did the same thing. And it's just, I did acquisitions initially. I think I did 40-ish deals before hiring anyone. And I quickly started to realize, like, this is not what these people care about. I mean, again, occasionally you get distress. We have a lead we might close today, distress, but it's not the majority. So just iteration is how I figured that out. And then just continually talking now with my acquisition people, what are you hearing, you know, and looking at on all the deals we are closing versus the ones that end up just listing on market and not being worth our time, you know, dissecting what were the buzzwords they were saying, the kind of things they were mentioning were important or weren't mentioning, versus those ones that we closed and so consistently when we hear, oh, you just want to get rid of it, or inherited it, or we were going to move, but we didn't, or we're getting old, just don't want to deal with it. Those are all kind of buzzwords. That's like, you know, hey, this is our avatar, or, oh, can't stand realtors. That's another good one.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're somewhat on the front lines, although you have somebody sort of picking up the calls and doing the negotiation for you. Is that right?
Well, on the front lines in the sense that I'm talking to my acquisition managers constantly, but not, I'm not doing any of that myself.
How long ago did you get an acquisition manager in place?
3 years was the first one.
Okay. Wow. So even through your acquisition manager, you're continuing to learn a lot. Did you notice a big difference? Letting go of that sort of acquisition process, having an acquisition manager, did it distance you yourself from your sellers? Or did you find it sort of accelerate things, you know, in terms of understanding and listening to your sellers?
That's a good question. I think it probably, I don't know, I communicated with, going back to that first one, I communicated with her enough and listened to her phone calls enough.
Okay.
I think I was still pretty equally in the know as far as what the sellers were thinking, because I continually am coaching and working with the acquisition people. So
in terms of the negotiation part of things, are you handling that, or is your acquisition manager handling that?
Them. I have no contact with the sellers unless something goes wrong and I have to deal with it.
That's so interesting that you don't have any contact, but you seem to be so in touch with your sellers, or, you know, maybe you're not constantly in touch, but it sounds like you're quite aligned, and it sounds like there's a lot of communication between you and your acquisition managers. Is that right?
That's the key. And so also just doing business all over the place. Another thing I do spend time doing is they'll tag me in Pebble all the time.
Yeah.
And having a question or something weird came up or whatever. And so I see all their notes where I get a good idea of the conversation, what the seller's saying, right? And we're constantly talking and strategizing on, okay, you know, Mr. Seller said this, how do we go about closing this? So again, it's the constant communication with the acquisition people that keeps me pretty on top of what's going on.
All right. So you heard it from Dan. He's got two acquisition managers. He rolls lean and mean with his team. And you'll hear in this episode, you know, one of the things that he wished he did earlier was really get those playbooks in place earlier so he can bring on those team members earlier. It's so important, even as a solopreneur, to put yourself on the right track to scale your business, because this business is very scalable. And so if you don't have that and you're not on that track to scale your business, you're really starting to build yourself a high paying job. And that's what we're trying to avoid. At the end of the day, we came into land or real estate investing to find some sort of freedom and not, again, build a job around that. And that's why I run something called the Dirt Hacker Challenge. No, it's not a contest. It's not a challenge. Well, it is a challenge. It's a 5-day workshop with me. And I do challenge you to really go beyond what you're doing currently with your land business and think beyond in terms of, how do I actually put my business on track to scale? Okay, so this 5-day workshop that we go over an hour every day live with me, and we've got guest speakers as well, we really go through the framework of, how do we scale a business? I do not talk about pricing. I do not talk about picking counties. I do not talk about mailers or marketing. All I talk about is, how do we get into
the right track to scale your business. We talk about things like, how do we build playbooks? You know, how do we start with task lists and end up building our playbooks? Because playbooks and SOPs, or your standard operating procedures, these are the things that are going to allow you to scale your business. How do we create automations? So we'll do some technical work around that as well. And then also people, human resources are a huge part of scaling a business. I once heard from one of my favorite angel investors, he talks about two ways to only scale a business, or the two things that you have to do. It comes down to technology and people. And this is exactly what we're going to go through in the Dirt Hacker Challenge. It's a 5-day workshop with me, and we're going to go through exactly the framework to scaling a business. So if you're interested in joining this, I made this super accessible. It is $5, at least for now. When this was recorded, we might raise this again. It is available at dirthackerchallenge.com. You can sign up for that. That's dirthackerchallenge.com. I run this every single month. And by the way, when you sign up, you're going to get offered 3 free books. One of them I'm really excited about. We just launched this. It's our Real Land Talk book. You can see it on my camera here if you're watching the video. It is 250 pages worth of gems in here from all the conversations that I've had with other land investors, hundreds of hours baked in and reduced right in this book. And I'm going to send this to you free as long as you pay the shipping, along with a workbook, my good friend Travis King, his book as well, the Land Investors Playbook. So I'm going to send you all of that for free. Once you sign up for Dirt Hacker Challenge and you cover the shipping for that, I will get that out to you. Anyways, I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode here with Dan. What does constant communication with your acquisition managers look like? Are you guys always hopping on calls? Is it just through all asynchronous communication? I'm really curious as to how you keep your team so tight knit and still have a finger on the pulse here the whole time.
Working on getting better there, and definitely recently have gotten better there. Where, so on the new hire right now, there's going to be a morning huddle every day, very brief. And I'm going to do it twice a week. And then one of my acquisition guys is just going to do it with the new guy, 3 days a week. And so, okay. That, you know, set meetings, but then also just, you get the tags in Pebble, or I'll get a miscellaneous question, you know, they'll send me a voice message. But so we do talk quite a bit.
Got you. Now, how big, Dan, is your team now? You've got a couple acquisition managers. Who else is involved with the team?
Just the two acquisition people, because good title agents and attorneys, they'll handle the transaction coordination for you. it's amazing. So the girl I use down in Florida, who's also an attorney, which is incredibly helpful.
Wow.
They handle everything. Her and her assistant, once they get the contract on the buy side, yeah. Again, assuming something doesn't go wrong, we don't have to do anything. They do all the communication. Oh. And so a lot of the admin work gets handled there. And then on the sales side, we use realtors mostly. And so then, of course, the realtors handle the transaction coordination. So good title agents or attorneys, depending on the state, plus good realtors are worth their weight in gold.
Wow. Okay. Was there anything special you're looking for in terms of a title agent that you ended up landing on this? How can people find somebody like a title agent like this to alleviate so much work for you?
She was a referral, and there was plenty of bad title agents I went through to get to her.
Okay.
So, you know, asking other good people in the industry is a great way to get good referrals. Mm. And then ultimately, I think just the volume of business we give her.
Right.
She allows us, you know, some service right. That others might not get, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. So. That's incredible. You roll lean and mean here, and it sounds like business is booming for you guys on the land side of things. Am I correct by saying that?
Yeah. It's been a good year.
And it sounds like with your marketing, it's more about crafting the correct message. But is there any other tactics or strategies that you guys are testing that maybe you can share with the listeners here?
Yeah. So failed mail. Again, if you're using Pebble, it'll tell you the failed mail, calling those, calling the small amount of additional return mail that still gets returned. Okay. And then just different marketing methods and for areas that are really producing, hitting them over and over again. So an easy example, that market in Colorado I told you about where I first learned about land.
Yeah,
I haven't marketed there this year because things have, that market's changed a lot, but I marketed there for 4 years straight. And last fall, 20 some mailers in, we got a deal at 8,000 that we sold for 27, right? So, and that's after you. And so the point is, in the places that are really producing, we hit them over and over and over again. Mail, different type of mailer, cold call, and you never know what new business you'll drum up or who ignored you prior that will want to sell now. And so I think that's another important point. And then, those are the main things, just consistency over the long term. And then one more thing I'll say that's kind of a corollary to all that is the sales cycle, where sure, we get leads sometimes that will close 2, 3, 4 weeks within getting the lead. But we get a lot of leads that we close 6 to 12 months later after 30 to 60 to 70 follow-ups. So you got to have the long-term in mind when you start the business, both in your marketing and your follow-up. And again, you'll get those quick wins, but some of our biggest wins are 9, 12 months down the road.
So with those 9 to 12 months down the road, are you doing anything particular in terms of a follow-up to keep them warm, or, you know, how are you nurturing those kind of leads?
Working on making this better, where I got an integration set up via ActiveCampaign and Zapier, where I have a long-term follow-up column. And I have a couple long-term follow-up columns where they're now going to be getting emails every 30 or 45 days.
Gotcha.
But then plus just putting the task of call every 2 months or call once a quarter, just depending on what the prior phone call was like. So just staying on top of that and never leaving a deal without the next to do on it.
I love that. Now, I don't know if you've checked out, I know this is just recent, but we just recently launched the automated follow-ups there. And so with text and email and physical mail as well. So I hope you get a chance to test that out, Dan. I know you're using ActiveCampaign. I use ActiveCampaign for, you know, our users, not for land, but really interesting to hear that you've built out a pretty lengthy drip sequence to, again, keep them warm. So thank you so much for sharing that. Now, I want to quickly touch upon, what are you doing outside of land? So you're doing buy and holds. Are you also involved with any other forms of real estate?
No, not as of now. I mean, I think I mentioned started Ground Up Partners. We're providing capital for land deals, but for ourselves as well. Real estate is scalable to really any degree you want it to be.
Yeah.
So as far as business and making money, I'm spending my time entirely there for now. Not at this time.
Dan, if I were to ask you, you know, if you were to start land investing again today, knowing what you know, let's say knowing what you know today, what would the first 6 months look like? What would you get in place? What would you do? You know, let's get tactical here. What would exactly that look like?
I would have picked a couple key markets with strong fundamentals. And I personally prefer places where it's competitive and very easy to sell, but hard to buy. You know, I know plenty of people that go to rural areas where they can get deals for, you know, not that many mailers and it's not that competitive, but then it's harder to sell. I prefer kind of the opposite end of that spectrum. And then I wouldn't be so stingy on marketing, which I was initially, where I was too afraid to spend money on marketing. I definitely sold myself short initially there. And of course, it depends on what you have available. But if I didn't have much money available for mailers, I would not be bashful about cold calling, because cold calling has been great. And I would just be better about having all of the tracking in place from day one, which is something I'm still trying to make better. And then also just have that expectation in my head of, I'm doing this for years. I'm setting up a business for years. And so building out the SOPs and systems and tracking accordingly. And then the last thing I'll say on that too, is I would have, again, knowing what I know now, sooner started targeting larger projects, subdivides, that sort of thing, you know, where, again, pick a few areas, because this varies dramatically from place to place, but pick a few areas and start with either small projects or projects where someone more experienced is the major partner and you're more just learning, and learn that skill quicker, because that's scalable to a very, very substantial degree.
You mentioned cold calling. Mm-hmm. Is it your acquisition managers that are doing that as well? They're doing the cold calling. Okay. And I mean, are you doing anything differently with your cold calling process?
Working on getting better there too. The biggest things is prioritizing, you know, the failed mailers, the return mail. But other than that, it's just sifting, as how I think about it. You're sifting to look for your seller avatar. And so I try to, it's harder in areas that are less homogenous where there's a lot of variation in price point. Mm. But if they're calling somewhere that's pretty similar all over, then I have found it useful to have some sort of anchor in the script where, oh, hey, Jesse, great. You want to sell? Well, we just bought 123 Main Street at 14. So we could probably pay something like that for your land. Just so, because otherwise you can end up wasting a ton of time where you're just talking to retail sellers or people who are bored. And so if you're able to get some sort of anchor, but I didn't say that's what your lot is worth. I said, we bought that lot for that and we could probably pay. So it leaves me a little bit of open, you know, a little bit of an open door there. If it is worth more, or we can negotiate up.
Sure, sure. I noticed a couple of times you mentioned the word seller avatar. Mm-hmm. Can you break that down for the listeners here? What do you mean by that exactly?
Sure. So your seller profile, what does your customer look like? Because you can't really create your marketing unless you know who you're marketing to or who you're trying to get in touch with. You know, to make a really obvious example, my dad has the same name. He's 65. So I keep getting all kinds of things for retirees in the mail. They messed up, right? They're wasting their money selling or sending mail to a non-retiree, right? Very obvious example, but people do this all the time where, you know, going back to the whole quick cash close conversation, if that's not the motivation of the sellers that you want to get in touch with, then that's not going to work. Or, you know, if you are using all kinds of sophisticated terminology and you're, you know, mailing to people who are not sophisticated, that could be intimidating, right?
Right.
Or vice versa. This is another point too, because we bought from a lot of retired developers who maybe just have a few lots left. They've done hundreds of builds over their career and they have a few left. We've gotten good deals that way, but you got to have a basic understanding of development and new construction or they're not going to take you seriously. If you don't know what perk tests and plat maps are, you need to know these things. So that's another example where if you don't understand your avatar, how can you market to and communicate with them effectively?
So you're really getting to understand your sellers and also, you know, almost crafting the language into that to make sure you speak to that avatar, correct?
Yes. Yes, we're definitely trying to. And I really think about avoiding the buzzwords that are on everybody else's.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's almost, what's the word? It's almost just assumed if everybody's saying we'll pay closing costs. I've been meaning to take that off our post. Actually, I'm going to do that because everyone does. So it's not even valuable anymore to say that. And so I think that's been useful too. And one more point I want to make too, guys, especially if you're new and all this is intimidating where you're thinking, oh, I don't know that much about land. Mm-hmm. I don't have much money. If you're good with people and they like you, that's still the most important thing. Now, granted, if your marketing upfront's not right, they're never going to call you to get to that point. Right. But if you're good at just building rapport, asking good questions, that's still, I think, the most important skill once you're talking to them, because if they really like you, then they might not even consider other people and just talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Thanks for that. You know, just kind of putting a perspective spin on that. I think a lot of people don't really think about that. I get asked a lot of times, you know, what is a mailer that works and what's this? I really don't know. And you really don't know until you truly test for these things and get an understanding of your market. So, I hope a lot of you guys that are listening to this are going to take that into consideration. I've got a last question here specifically about marketing. Mailing sounds like it's a pretty dominant form of marketing for you guys. Is that true? And how do you feel about mailing?
Yes. And I will say in the last 12 months, we've probably gotten almost as many cold call deals as mailing deals.
Wow.
Believe it or not. So we're working on expanding that. I think I mentioned a couple times I'm hiring. And so I'm structuring this differently where the new acquisition manager, actually, I'm giving them a different name to start, outbound lead specialist. And they're going to be entirely cold calling to start.
Wow.
Because it has been ultra productive. And when I look through Pebble and I look through these deals closed, so many of them failed mailers. Mm-hmm. Those have been really powerful, calling the failed mailers and getting in touch with people that others are not. Yeah. And then we're experimenting with some other stuff, ringless voicemail.
Yeah.
But I don't have any feedback for you yet because we're just starting that.
Got you. Dan, I very much, and I'm sure our listeners very much appreciate you sort of sharing all of those insights. I've got something I call the quick fire round here. I'd love to understand Dan outside of land. So I've got some questions that are not related to land here. So outside of land, Dan, what do you like doing?
Snowboard, mountain biking, always traveling, going to Japan next month.
No way.
So I travel a lot, right? Because I can do this from anywhere. So yeah. I usually go somewhere every month. I love surfing, even though I'm terrible at it. So I like anything outside, really.
That's awesome. Do you go to Japan often?
No, this will be my first trip there. So this will be interesting.
Amazing. You're gonna have a blast up there. I go there pretty frequently. What would you say is your biggest pet peeve?
In business, in general?
In general or in business, up to you.
Oh, man. Oh, that's a hard one. My biggest pet peeve, you got me at a little bit of a loss here. I don't know.
Is it easier within the business, world of business?
Yeah, let's do that. Within the world of business, probably my biggest pet peeve is passive-aggressive title agents who are unpleasant. Because I'm telling you, Jesse, we could do a whole episode on this. The title world is going to get disrupted well within our lifetimes. And these very unpleasant, unfriendly, unreliable title agents will no longer have a job, and only the good ones will remain, because the blockchain will help fix this. And it's just it's so inefficient, antiquated. I think that will get disrupted. And I definitely have had so many frustrating experiences with title companies.
Oh, man, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay.
Oh, man. Okay. If you had to recommend one book that you read recently, what would it be and why? I don't even know if you read, but I'm going to throw it out there.
I do quite frequently. Same as ever. I forget the name of the author, but as the name states, he talks through how, given the rapid change in the world around technology, what are the things that never change? And so much of it relates to human nature, and that is a fantastic read. I read it. I flipped to page one. I read it again. Highly recommend.
Same as ever. Is that the book?
Yes.
Okay. I'll make sure to include that in the show notes. A couple more here. One bad habit that you're actively working on, Dan.
I probably drink too much coffee.
All right. So you're a coffee addict. Okay. Last one here. Who would you recommend to have on this podcast and why?
Oh, if you haven't had Mason McDonald, he would be a great guest.
Okay.
Different background than me.
Awesome.
So he would be a fun one, I think.
Okay. Because of the different background on how you guys started land?
Yeah. And our businesses are very different, even though we're, he would be a good one to talk to.
Awesome. Dan, you've been awesome to interview. How can people engage with you? How can people reach out to you? How can people learn more about you?
Yeah, so danhabercost.com or on any of the socials. And then if you have a land deal and you're looking for a capital partner, it's GUP Land. So GUPland.com, standing for Ground Up Partners, land.com.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. So I'll make sure to include that. Now, did you mention that you have a podcast with Mason as well?
Yes. Oh, The Big Picture Blueprint. And Mason and I interview all kinds of people within real estate, outside of real estate. But the idea is there's a lot of podcasts for newer people. We're more focused on people who already own real estate or have a business or of some kind.
Yeah.
So we don't define every term and start very intro. We try and focus on higher level conversations about running, scaling, and growing businesses.
Wow. How long have you been doing that for?
8 months. And I can't believe the traction we've gotten in 8 months. We have all kinds of people we've never met listening and reaching out. So that's been awesome.
So is it mainly focused on around real estate?
It is a lot of real estate talk, but we get people of all, not just the active land investors or apartment investors like us. You know, we had David Richter on, who a lot of people you probably recognize his name, talking about the financials and how to better that side of your business. So kind of all over the board in all segments of business, not just talking acquisitions all day long.
That's awesome. Well, best of luck with that. And what's the podcast name again?
The Big Picture Blueprint.
The Big Picture Blueprint. I'll make sure to include that in the show notes. Dan, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. And I'm so grateful that you shared some really eye-opening things, specifically, you know, how you're crafting the message in your marketing. I hope everybody takes that seriously and reconsiders the way they're handling the marketing and not sort of ending up in sort of this sort of groupthink mentality here. So, Dan, once again, thanks so much for coming on the podcast here.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Cheers.
Before you stop this episode or hit the next episode, I want to personally thank you for listening to this episode of the Land Investing Business Secrets podcast by Pebble. If you found this helpful, we greatly appreciate any awesome reviews and ratings on whichever platform you are listening to this on. And if you have 2 minutes and wanted to step it up even more and help others, feel free to share this in other Facebook groups or pages or any communities, giving others a heads up of the Land Investing Business Secrets podcast or the specific episode that may help them on their land investing journey. Once again, thanks so much for listening, and catch you on our next episode.